The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Chris Canangla for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Indie Week. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the July 1st edition, which is published online every Wednesday. The lead story in this week is a Raleigh neighborhood ditched its slave-owning namesake. Some are still fighting to keep it. Many residents of the neighborhood formerly called Cameron Park say they've moved on under a new name, Forest Park, but some want a court to declare the name change invalid. The neighborhood known either as Cameron Park or Forest Park, depending on which side of the debate you're on, is one of Raleigh's oldest and stateliest. Tucked off Hillsborough Street, it's a patchwork of genteel, colonial, and Queen Anne-style homes situated on ample lawns and shaded by oaks, ashes, and elms. Most of the 800 or so residents are wealthy and liberal. Some are politicians and university chancellors. The vibe is friendly. People know their neighbors. They hang out at the bar down the street. They barbecue together. Quote, "When we moved here the first few days, we literally had to start spying out our windows," recalls Joel Luterman, president of the Forest Park Neighborhood Association. "Neighbors were stopping by to talk to us, and we couldn't get any work done." The neighborhood has an active listserv and serves as a forum for party invitations, furniture giveaways, and the occasional spirited hyperlocal argument. In early 2021, it lit up with discussions about whether Cameron Park should change its name due to its namesake's connection to slavery. Over the next 5 years, the debate would cleave the otherwise close-knit, politically homogeneous community into two factions, each claiming to have history, the law, and racial politics on their side. A series of surveys and votes culminated in a decision to rename the neighborhood Forest Park in 2022. Then, last year, six neighbors filed a lawsuit claiming the name change process had been flawed and should be deemed invalid. And although they voluntarily dismissed their suit this spring, they say they plan to bring it back. The plaintiffs plan to again ask the court to declare that the neighborhood association's renaming process was improper, said their lawyer, Robin Tatum. And they'll ask the court to clarify the procedure for how the neighborhood could legally change its name. The Indy spoke to neighbors, current and former neighborhood association presidents, and the lead plaintiff on the lawsuit, and combed through court records and emails to understand why this debate still hasn't been put to rest. A majority of people seem to have accepted the change and moved on, but a vocal minority refuses to let it die. The Cameron legacy. Born in 1777, Duncan Cameron was a judge, state lawmaker, and University of North Carolina trustee. He and his family owned thousands of acres of plantations and more than 1,000 slaves. He also owned the land that became Cameron Park. This land was never a plantation, and he leased some of it to the Episcopal School of North Carolina, which became St. Mary's School. By the 1900s, developers had acquired the land and planned a suburb for the growing and industrializing capital city. A wave of new upper-middle-class professionals needed somewhere to live. Early advertisements for the neighborhood courted upper-middle-class businessmen, government officials, professors, and lawyers seeking to solidify their rising socioeconomic status and the prestigious address. Everyone who is familiar with Raleigh recognizes that Cameron Park enjoys the best social conditions available to our city, one 1914 ad promised. There are no poor sections. There are no bad approaches. In fact, there is nothing that anyone need apologize for in any way. But the neighborhood achieved its rarefied reputation in an ugly way. Among the irreproachable social conditions that made it desirable for early residents were racist covenants that excluded black residents. In 1948, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that racially restrictive covenants were unenforceable. The Fair Housing Act of 1968 banned them outright. But Raleigh's residential segregation persisted, and the neighborhood remains overwhelmingly white to this day. After George Floyd's killing and the racial justice protests of 2020, Raleigh's Cameron Village Shopping Center and Cameron Village Regional Library changed their names to the Village District and Oberlin Regional Library, respectively. Several months later, some Cameron Park neighbors began to wonder if they should follow suit. In February 2021, the Cameron Park Neighborhood Association's Executive Committee formed a 9-person committee to explore the possibility of changing the neighborhood's name. 3 members supported keeping the name, 3 supported changing it, and 3 were undecided. The committee brought in historians and civil rights advocates to make the case for and against the name change. At one resident forum, a historian shared archival evidence of violence, sexual assaults, and family separations committed against people enslaved by the Cameron family. In one primary source account, an enslaved man named James Curry described how Duncan Cameron himself used to carry a large cane, and if he met a black man on the road and he did not raise his hat and bow to him, he would beat him with his cane. Another historian countered that Cameron Park has been a neighborhood for longer than it was owned by the Camerons, and that Cameron is one of many place names in Raleigh that come from slaveholders. The name Cameron Park now stands for a century of neighborhood history unrelated to the family, she said. The naming committee surveyed residents on whether to even consider a name change. According to the Neighborhood Association's records, a majority of the 250 survey respondents said they wanted to. In September of 2021, the Neighborhood Association held an up or down vote on the name change. Its bylaws state that issues shall be determined by a simple majority of neighborhood members present and voting, except when related to adoption or amendment of these bylaws, leading the executive committee to conclude that a simple majority of votes would be sufficient for a name change. All full-time residents over 18 were eligible to vote, roughly 600 people, the Neighborhood Association estimated. They offered in-person, absentee, and online voting options. Volunteers from the pro- and anti-Cameron Park camps helped count the ballots to ensure fairness. The final tally was 240 to 201 in favor of renaming, not a landslide, but enough to proceed. In March of 2022, the Neighborhood Association held a second vote to choose a new name. It used a ranked choice ballot to select from 4 options. The admittedly bland Forest Park won. Then the Neighborhood Association set about implementing the change. It contacted the City of Raleigh and companies like Google, Apple, and Wikipedia. It filed an assumed name or doing business as DBA certificate with the Wake County Register of Deeds to change its own name to the Forest Park Neighborhood Association. The name Cameron Park would still appear on the Neighborhood Association's bylaws, but it would refer to itself everywhere else as Forest Park. In 2024, the Raleigh City Council voted to update the Cameron Park Neighborhood Conservation Overlay District, a special zoning designation, to reflect the new name. It was reported at the time that this was the last city document with the name Cameron Park on it. During the public hearing ahead of the vote, Forest Park resident Holda Glau said 14 residents of color, including every single black resident and almost every Asian American neighbor I know of, had co-written a statement in support of renaming. In parentheses, the Indy was not able to reach any of Forest Park's black residents for this story. We're not so naive to think that renaming our neighborhood will protect our children from racism, but the name change has been a powerful, uplifting symbol, reminding our families that the community around us reflects hope and change for the better, said Lau, who is Asian American. The council agreed to update the zoning designation in a 7-1 vote. Only then Mayor Marianne Baldwin opposed the motion, citing a lack of consensus in the neighborhood and a desire not to expose the city to a lawsuit. A year later, in October 2025, 6 neighbors filed a lawsuit against the Neighborhood Association, asserting that its voting methodology had been flawed and the name change was invalid. The suit describes how some residents had wished to distance their neighborhood from the Camerons. Other residents, the complaint continued, took a different approach and were concerned about the importance of preserving rather than erasing the history of one of the state's oldest historical neighborhoods, including its original name. Although just as committed to racial justice as the name change proponents, this group did not believe that renaming Cameron Park was a wise or effective method to achieve this goal. The plaintiffs argue the neighborhood association should have required a two-thirds margin to approve the name change instead of a simple majority. These bylaws may be amended by a vote of two-thirds of the members present, and voting at a meeting called for the purpose of amending these bylaws, the bylaws state. They were never amended and still refer to the neighborhood and neighborhood association as Cameron Park. The plaintiffs, including Myrick Howard, a resident of almost 50 years, see the DBA certificate as a bad faith loophole the neighborhood association's leaders used to push the name change through without a two-thirds vote to change the bylaws. The neighborhood association countered that the DBA certificate was simply the most effective way to carry out the will of a majority of voting neighbors, and changing the neighborhood association bylaws is unnecessary to change the name of the neighborhood. But arguments about voting technicalities are secondary to the pro-Cameron Park camp's assertion that the renaming was unnecessary and misguided to begin with. In May, the plaintiffs agreed to voluntarily dismiss their lawsuit without prejudice, rather than enter into an arduous and expensive discovery process where they would have had to produce years' worth of emails and documents, but they left the door open to refiling, which they now say they intend to do. Howard retired recently as president of Preservation North Carolina, a respected nonprofit dedicated to protecting and restoring historic buildings around the state. The lawsuit's first named plaintiff and most outspoken, Howard said he believes that renaming Cameron Park was about virtue signaling rather than having a real racial reckoning. This is a way that some white folks who support racial justice can feel better about their neighborhood, which is lily white, he said, adding that the vote was a meaningless gesture that does nothing to help except to make people feel better about themselves. Howard said he'd like to do something more substantive, like create a neighborhood scholarship fund for minority students. Residents could donate 1% of their assessed property value over a 5-year period, he proposed. That would move the needle way more than changing a name, he said. Howard also said the Cameron legacy is more varied than some of his neighbors admit. I call it bumper sticker history, he said. If you can boil it down to one sentence, you've got it wrong. In this case, Duncan Cameron was a complex person. Howard has debated neighbors on this for years now. People said to me, I don't understand how you can sleep knowing that this was part of the Cameron Plantation, he said. I'm thinking, well, it wasn't part of Cameron Plantation, but can you sleep at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City? Because slavery was all over this country. Other supporters of the Cameron Park name did not reply to the Indy's interview requests. Howard said he and his 5 co-plaintiffs have raised about $31,000 from between 15 and 20 neighbors to cover their legal expenses, and plan to modify their argument in their forthcoming suit. But almost every other neighbor the Indy spoke with to insist the plaintiffs are fighting for a lost cause. Joel Lutterman and Michael Lindsay, the current president and immediate former president of the Neighborhood Association, said the plaintiffs represent a small minority of neighbors who haven't accepted the results of the renaming process. The vast majority has moved on and wants this issue to go away, Lindsay wrote in an email. I say that as a person who argued for keeping the Cameron Park name and voted that way. Richard Gus Gussler has lived in the neighborhood for 40 years and owns the Players Retreat, a popular neighborhood hangout. He hadn't heard of the original lawsuit until the Indy asked him what he thought about it. I sit and talk with all the neighborhood people that come into the PR, and the name change has not come up in any discussion I've had with anybody, period, Gussler said. I was very happy with changing the name. Do I like the name Forest Park? Not particularly, but for me, any name's better than having that man's name on the neighborhood I live in, and I've never really gotten into any arguments about it. Ron Acock is a retired lawyer who has lived here for about 25 years. He felt the name change process was comprehensive, fair, and in compliance with rules. There was an intensive discussion period online and in person. Folks were given the opportunity to express their opinion. Voting was done on a very adequate basis, so I think the controversy should be over. Acock said he regularly attends neighborhood get-togethers, and the same change debate never comes up. At this point, he said it's a controversy engendered by a few and not cared about by the many. Well, that may be true, but hard feelings persist. In late May, when the Cameron Park contingent dismissed the lawsuit, the listserv was once again a flurry with commentary, including a letter from the plaintiff's lawyer to the neighborhood association's lawyer describing several concessions they feel they extracted in the lawsuit related to the neighborhood association's legal name still being Cameron Park. Eventually, the listserv moderator stepped in. Renewing the name change debate of 2021-22 on this listserv will destroy it, the moderator wrote. Just last week, residents attempted to relitigate the naming during a neighborhood association meeting held on Zoom. Lindsay recapped the renaming process, and Howard explained that he intends to bring back his lawsuit. The conversation quickly devolved. "Myrick, you are destroying this neighborhood," one resident commented in the Zoom chat, which the Indy viewed. "We voted. We decided. Please let it go." It is the defamatory statements made by Mike L. that are destroying the neighborhood, another resident replied, referring to Lindsay. People on both sides of the naming debate have supported their positions with historical and legal documents. But at the end of the day, names are social constructs. So are neighborhoods, whose boundaries are invented, blurry, and changeable. What is on the deeds and maps doesn't matter as much as what people actually call it. The neighborhood associations do not believe any court has the authority to reverse the neighborhood name change, the defendant's lawyer, Neil Ryman, wrote in an email to the Indy. So what do the majority of residents call the place they live? Predictably, accounts differed. Here are still some people that, when they refer to the neighborhood in either the listserv or in flyers that we put up under people's doormats announcing one thing or another, still refer to the neighborhood as Cameron Park, Lutterman said. To me, that's, well, I won't say immature exactly, but it's like, come on. It's time to move on. Howard is firm. It's Cameron Park. All right, time now to talk about issues in another neighborhood. These are not historical issues. These are very much in the present and urgent. A year after Chantal, Durham's Old Farm neighborhood is still recovering. With disaster aid limited, some residents have struggled to repair their homes or afford to keep them at all. At about 2:30 a.m. on July 6, 2025, Jamaica Autry awoke to a frantic call from her neighbor. Floodwater had pooled into their house, they said, and Autry and her mother, Winona, needed to leave fast in case their home was next. Autry, still half asleep, opened the back door to her house on Peppercorn Street. Quote, "There was no porch. There were no steps. We were literally surrounded by water and couldn't get out," she said. After dialing 911 twice, Autry and her mother were rescued by boat before the floodwaters rushed into their home. The next day, it was gutted. Overwhelmed by repair costs, she and Winona had to sell the house in November. Every Old Farm resident remembers the exact early morning moment when they learned Tropical Storm Chantal's floodwaters were violently rushing their tranquil neighborhood in North Durham. For many, like Autry, it was the last time they saw their homes intact. For some, it was the last time they lived there at all. You literally just see your house, your childhood house, torn down to nothing. You have to throw out all of your furniture. It's a devastating experience. I wouldn't wish it on most people, probably not even my worst enemy, Autry said. Nearly a year later, Old Farm is still in disaster response mode. Some residents remain displaced from their homes, with Chantal leaving structural damage and mold in its wake. Homeowners scrambled and are still scrambling to find somewhere habitable to stay throughout repairs. Others, many of whom have lived there for more than four decades, sold their longtime homes to eager real estate investors, unable to shoulder the financial burden of repairs, an onus compounded by a lack of federal aid, meager state grants, and outdated floodplain maps that left some without flood insurance. Driving around Old Farm today, some houses are boarded up and stagnant as if they hadn't been touched since July. Repair vans are haphazardly parked about the winding streets, both to fix up the homes of remaining residents and to make others that were bought by LLCs look polished, brand new, white, and unrecognizable. excuse me. Tropical Storm Chantel unleashed historic rainfall in isolated pockets of central North Carolina. The sliver of Durham County that Chantel hit and hit hard was Old Farm and Forest and River Forest, two adjacent historically black neighborhoods along the Eno River, which rose to a record high due to the storm. The streets of Old Farm transformed into turbid, rushing waterways, claiming cars and the bottommost levels of many homes, leaving residents stranded at the mercy of water rescue boats. More than 100 Durham residents, mainly in Old Farm and River Forest, were water rescued, while others, like Morgan Fielding, had a shelter in place to wait out the flood. Fielding, a remote tech worker in her 40s, joked wryly that on the day Chantel hit, she learned she wasn't someone who did well in an emergency. Lying in bed that night, she knew the power had gone out when her white noise machine cut off abruptly. Fielding was fully prepared to roll over and go back to sleep, but was jolted wide awake the moment her partner, Neil Smith, told her there was water pooling into their basement. Smith, whom Fielding commended for being calm under pressure, immediately started hauling their belongings up to the second floor. I remember standing at the top of the stairs. It's pitch black, probably a foot and a half, 2 feet of muddy water sloshing through downstairs, and I just couldn't rationalize that that was happening inside our home, Fielding said, becoming sullen as she recounted the event and stroked one of her cats, who leapt into their wooden dining room table, two surviving reminders of her home as it was before the flood. Senior residents with disabilities, some, were especially vulnerable to the sudden and rushing floodwaters. Tanya Exum Costin lives in the southernmost part of the neighborhood, but the home of her elderly parents, Walter and Marilyn Exum, who lived in Old Farm since the 70s, sits farther north, right on the riverbank. Though just a 10-minute walk away, she realized she couldn't get to them. Neither could swim, and her father used a walker all the time. I just kept calling and kept driving around to the various streets to where I could see down to their house and calling my mom on the phone, Exum Costin said. She said they both huddled on their beds to wait for help, and after she notified emergency services, a rescue team saved her parents by boat with a wheelchair for her father. Floods from Chantel impacted 35 of the 462 homes in Old Farm. Starla Tanner, director of the City of Durham's new Community Partnerships and Engagement Department, told the City Council during a May 18th update. In next-door River Forest, she said 29 of 169 homes were affected. Tanner said the most prevalent kinds of damage are structural interior and utility-related. Mold and poor indoor air quality are also concerns. Of the impacted homes in Old Farm, she said residents had been able to repair and return to 5. Repairs were in progress at 10, whether or not residents had returned, and residents had left 8 as of the May 18th update. The status of another 12 homes was unknown, meaning the city could not get in touch with residents, Tanner told the council. As it stands, Tanner said at the meeting, repair efforts are being hindered by limited contractor availability, high costs, and bureaucracy that's confusing and unfamiliar to residents trying to get financial aid and file insurance claims. Old Farm residents, for their part, told the Indy they feel forgotten in media coverage by their government and by their fellow North Carolinians. Many wonder whether it's because of the neighborhood's predominant population of black and elderly folks, coupled with the comparatively low number of homes impacted. There'd been little in terms of resources for rebuilding after the initial phase, when we did have a large community effort towards cleaning out the homes, Trey Gilmore, president of the Old Farm Neighborhood Association, told the Indy. Probably 75% or 80% of those affected by the flood were able to get some volunteer services for cleaning out the water and the mud after the flood, but when it came to rebuilding, it was a drastic lack of support. So what about disaster aid? Well, what hit Old Farm nearly as hard as Chantel itself was the resulting wave of displacement. A lack of federal aid, coupled with repair costs that outweighed available state grant money, meant residents who couldn't afford to fix their homes were left with little choice but to move out of the tight-knit neighborhood where they had grown up, raised their children, and built their lives. Others moved in with family members or friends or stayed in their damaged homes amid the repair process. Their experiences echo those of North Carolinians and other parts of the state who have seen similar barriers to aid in the wake of flooding. state recovery efforts following Hurricanes Matthew and Florence in 2016 and 2018 were plagued by delays, while federal and state aid have been painstakingly slow to arrive in western North Carolina communities devastated by Hurricane Helene in 2024, the Assembly and ProPublica have found. Old Farm is the kind of place residents live for generations and pass down their homes to their children with a sense of pride. But most of those who sold their homes received the price of the flood-damaged versions due to a lack of funding for federal, state, or city buyouts. Of those who had to leave permanently, some were eligible for state aid and federal loans from the Small Business Administration, but some weren't. Some had flood insurance for homes in a designated floodplain, but houses right across the street didn't have the same protection. Chantal's destruction and resulting financial strain didn't spare those who had done the right things to prepare or respond. Though it's the most intuitive funding stream for disaster aid, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, was no help to Old Farm residents. Chantal impacted fewer than 500 homes total, meaning it didn't meet the minimum threshold for direct individual assistance, so the state didn't request it. FEMA did reimburse municipalities and counties to the tune of $32 million for emergency response spending after the Trump administration declared Chantal a major disaster in September, 2 months after it hit. But the city of Durham couldn't use federal dollars to purchase impacted homes from Old Farm and River Forest residents, leaving many to list on the private market. Residents were eligible for state grants after Chantal, though the money was slow to come through. As of early December, Old Farm residents hadn't received any state grant money. Let me say that again. As of early December, Old Farm residents hadn't received any state grant money. The Ninth Street Journal previously reported, even if they got through the arduous paperwork and back and forth with state caseworkers, fortunately for some, the grant money, at most $43,600 per household, did arrive beginning later that month. The state dispersed more than $4.6 million to North Carolinians affected by Chantal. Justin Graney, a spokesperson for the North Carolina Department of Public Safety's Emergency Management Division, wrote in a statement to the Indy, "But not everyone in that unlucky portion of North Durham got help." Graney wrote that 36 state individual assistance applications were denied in Durham County, quote, with the most common reasons for denial being that the applicant had a duplication of benefits, meaning they had benefits from insurance or another source. 11 of those denials were appealed, with 7 eventually granted once applications provided the requested documentation. The Department of Public Safety attempts to work with its residents whenever possible, he added. Parentheses, data on how applications broke down specifically in Old Farm are not available. Exum Costin's parents were among those who applied but were denied money. Since the Exums' house was in the floodplain, they did have flood insurance, though the coverage was not quite enough to pay for all the damage and loss. Parentheses, state aid is secondary, so it would have covered what insurance didn't. The couple is repairing their home with plans of returning, but in the meantime is renting another house nearby, paying for two homes at once. Exum Costin said that now they are fighting against time to repair their home before their lease or money runs out. That is a significant cost if you're paying probably $2,000 in rent a month for over a year for retired people who are in their 80s, Exum Costin said. And both my parents are retired school teachers, so they don't have tons of money to spend on these costs. For Fielding and Smith, the cost of repairing the ground and first floors of their home, plus replacing items they lost, amounted to about $75,000. About half is covered by the $43,600 in state assistance. The rest, they're paying out of pocket. The financial burden has meant they had to give up on trying to have a child through IVF treatments. We bought this house thinking we would have a family in it. And then now to think, we might not have a family because of this house, Fielding said. A neighborhood forever changed again. The displacement Old Farm residents have experienced in the wake of Chantal is reminiscent of the reason why many families set roots in the neighborhood at all. Built through the 60s and 70s, Old Farm spawned from the implementation of urban renewal, which built the Durham Freeway directly through Durham's Black Wall Street and Haiti neighborhood. pushing black working-class families out of the prosperous district and leaving them to seek community elsewhere. For some, that happened to be in a neighborhood right along the banks of the Eno River, partially situated in a FEMA-designated floodplain. The Old Farm Neighborhood Association's website states that migration was a movement that allowed many youths reared in Old Farm, now 40 to 60-year-olds, to proudly boast of an incredible childhood and a village that still consists of many of those amazing parents today. Well, since Sunshall inundated the neighborhood, nearly 15 homes in Old Farm have been sold, many to LLCs for far less than their assessed pre-storm value. Some have already been flipped and sold or sit on the market, a couple of them with their once rouge-colored brick exteriors painted a stark white. Resident Carolyn Young's home on Rippling Stream Road, for example, sold for $190,000 but had an appraised value of $266,550 before the flood. A few houses down, another home appraised at $274,918 sold for $140,000. That's about half. Real estate listing sites peg their estimated market value right before Chantel at about $332,600 and $324,400, respectively. Shala Perla, who is still in the midst of repairing her home shed and fencing, said she has watched gentrification sweep Durham and is sure Old Farm is next. I mean, Old Farm has a history. It is clear who lived here on this land and who tilled this soil, Perla said. Still, she can't fathom why real estate investors have already started to drop hundreds of thousands of dollars on homes in and near a flood zone. It's just interesting to me how they could just build there now, knowing what happened, she said. And I'm like, who's going to buy houses? Are they even going to sell them? Are they even going to tell them? Even though Young, a retired Durham Public Schools teacher, sold her home of 50 years at a loss after the flood, she still serves as a treasurer for the Old Farm Neighborhood Association, collecting dues to help keep it running. For her and some of her close-knit elderly neighbors, being forced to leave after Chantel wrecked their homes was, at that point in their lives, devastating, Young said. She also still dotingly calls her former Rippling Stream Road home, my house. She spoke at length about her good care, the good care she took of it, whether she was painting, fixing things on her roof, or tending her garden's bright green grass and lush flowers. We're supposed to be able to just go work on our yards, you know, go work in our gardens, sit down on your patio, sit down on your decks, do nothing if you want. State Senator Sophia Chitlick, a Democrat who represents North Durham, introduced a bill in April that would establish a $25 million Tropical Storm Chantel Mitigation Fund. The appropriation would let the state buy flooded properties in the absence of federal buyout funding and provide eligible residents in Durham, Alamance, Caswell, Chatham, Moore, Orange, and Person counties with up to $500,000 for repair or relocation. But as Chitlick told the Indy, the bill is somewhat of a long shot. It can't move forward until Republicans pass the very delayed state budget, which could mean years before residents see additional finance support. And some legislators are concerned that the state taking the unusual step of buying out properties sets a precedent that the General Assembly has to do FEMA's job. I've been trying to advocate with my colleagues across the aisle that this is not precedent-setting. This is about a gap funding situation. Gilmore, the Neighborhood Association president, said he has discussed forming a long-term recovery group with Chitlick and Tanner from the city of Durham. He's hoping to partner with nonprofits, faith-based organizations, and government agencies to meet the needs of Chantel survivors that remain unmet, such as pooling resources to assist with reconstruction and closing financial gaps. Tanner told the Indy that the idea is in its infancy, but that Durham is communicating with disaster response nonprofit Day One Relief about a potential partnership, and that in the meantime, the city will continue supporting Old Farm residents. A more permanent coalition would be ideal for Old Farm, where flooding is routine, whether during a heavy rain, Hurricane Fran in 1996, or Hurricane Florence in 2018. The tropical storm has stirred discomfort among residents about the very real possibility of a severe weather event happening again, the Eno River turning their quiet neighborhood streets into waterways and pulling their livelihoods downstream. As the weather gets warmer again, everyone is coping with it in different ways. Some have go bags packed or escape plans prepped in case they need to flee, in the middle of the night again. Fielding is trying not to think about it too much and fights the urge to live with caution now that the neighbors all know each other a little better after leaning on each other to recover from Chantal. Fielding says it feels good to spend time with them for cookouts or movie nights in spaces that once evoked fear. With each day, they get further away from that night that was full of it. Perla, despite her reverence for the community, is antsy to leave. Her husband is a war veteran, and she said was shaken by the sudden flood. Her stepfather, who has an autoimmune disorder, had to move out due to mold and air quality risks. But their recently repaired home is still a place of solace for her husband and son, so she isn't looking to sell quite yet, though that could change if another storm like Chantal hits. I feel like we're at the will of whatever happens, Perla said. And now for a story not about the abundance of water, but the lack of it. This story is entitled Epicenters of Dryness, talking with a state climatologist about the Triangle's ongoing drought. How bad is the drought in the Triangle, and what will it take to get out of it? Lakes across the Triangle are beginning to look like the surface of Mars, though no one has been forced to emulate fictional astronaut Mark Watney and turn rocket fuel into water for survival. The Triangle is in the midst of the worst drought the region has seen in over a decade, one of the hardest hit areas in a state where every corner is experiencing some level of drought. Corey Davis has spent his career understanding environmental scenarios like the one Triangle residents are facing today. With degrees in meteorology and atmospheric science, Davis serves as an assistant state climatologist at North Carolina State University's Climate Office. The primary scientific extension resource for weather and climate science for the state of North Carolina, and leads the charge on drought and fire weather analysis for the North Carolina Drought Management Advisory Council. So we asked Davis to contextualize the current drought, what to expect moving forward, and how residents can best prepare themselves against these weather conditions now and in the future. The interview has been edited for length and clarity. So it's a Q&A. Indy. When did this drought officially begin? Said Davis. Well, the middle of last August is when we first started getting into a dry spell. Initially, it really wasn't that big of a deal because we had plenty of rain earlier in the summer last year, especially folks just west of the Triangle. Remember Tropical Storm Chantal? We just talked about that. We got tons of rain from that system. Going into last fall, we really didn't see any more tropical activity. I know folks don't like tropical storms and hurricanes, but they are responsible for a decent chunk of our rainfall during that time of the year. That was the fifth fall in a row where we had gone into drought during that time of year. Now, folks remember the one big snow that we had at the end of January. That snow did not really benefit us all that much. For one, this was one of those very dry, powdery snows. Not even though some places saw 10 or 12 inches, that amounted to less than an inch of liquid precipitation. But also because it stayed so cold for a week, and so after the snow fell, the ground was frozen. None of that melting snow was able to infiltrate down into the ground. So going into the winter, we had most of the state in moderate drought conditions. That's the lowest level of drought on the U.S. Drought Monitor. Unless you're a farmer who was trying to get your wheat fields planted last fall, you probably really didn't notice the impacts of the dryness at that point. By the end of February, we were mostly in severe drought conditions across the state. That's the second level on the drought monitor scale. I think when most people really started to notice this drought was by late March, early April. So when we hit the next level up, the extreme drought category, that was a big surprise for a lot of people because they didn't realize that we were dealing with drought in the first place. Now we're starting to see pockets of exceptional drought. That is the worst category, mainly from I-40 north to the Virginia border, including most of Durham County. That has really been one of our epicenters of dryness so far this year. It is on track for the driest year on record at the Raleigh-Durham Airport. Places like Chapel Hill are also running one of their driest ever starts to a year. And if you look at the impacts, they're widespread now. You cannot ignore these anymore. We're seeing lake levels that are extremely low for any time of year, but especially going into the summer. If you go out to a farm, you'll notice that the crops are struggling. A lot of the leaves are rolling or twisting or wilting, which is a sign of both the heat stress and the moisture stress that they're going through. And, of course, most parts of the Triangle now are in some degree of water conservation or water restrictions. Question. You mentioned that we've had five falls in a row with these dry conditions. What created these drought conditions? Is it climate change? Is something about the weather patterns year over year changing that makes this less unique than it was a decade ago? Well, that's a good question, and it's a little bit tough to answer because there are so many factors that play into this. A lot of it really is just bad luck. If you look back at the past five falls, there have been similar patterns that have caused us to go into these droughts, but I think there are some common factors here, and a lot of them relate back to climate change. We know when we have warmer temperatures, we have higher evaporation rates, and that can cause these drought conditions to emerge more quickly. The other big change that we've noticed in our weather is what we started calling weather whiplash. It's going from the wet periods to the dry ones with almost no warning. And if you think back to how this drought first emerged last summer, it was really one of those whiplash episodes. We were very wet last July and going into August, and by the time we got to the middle of August, it was like somebody just turned the spigot off. The opposite is true as well. We've had droughts and dry periods that have suddenly ended by getting into an extremely wet pattern. Right now, we're on the dry side, but it would not surprise me if this drought could start ending pretty abruptly later this year if we start getting to a more reliably wet pattern. So, question, what are some of the lesser-known impacts of the drought? A lot of folks know they can't wash their car at home or they're not supposed to water the lawn, but what might they not be thinking about? Well, these extreme drought events that do affect our way of life are very rare. We tend to only see these maybe every 10 to 20 years. That can affect the ability to go out on the lake and take a boat ride or go fishing, as most folks are seeing now. But that also affects how you can use water at your house and in the garden. We do not ask folks to conserve water or restrict their water use the vast majority of years. It's really only when we get into these extreme cases that we're doing that. It's a community effort to make sure that we're managing the water as best we can, saving those supplies so that we don't get to a point of running out of water. Agriculture is probably the other big impact right now. It's been a really dismal year so far for the farmers. We mentioned that they already are in a dry spell late last year. If they were trying to get their cover crops, whether it's pastures or wheat planted, they already really didn't have a lot of moisture late last year, and they never got that moisture over the winter either. So the pastures are in really bad shape right now. There's a concern that those pastures and hay fields will not be fruitful enough to feed their animals for the rest of the year. Of course, all of our main staple crops in North Carolina are feeling effects right now, corn especially. This is a time of year that is just critical for corn to get enough moisture. So the farmers really need some rain soon to be able to salvage the crops that they still have in their fields. Question. What can we as individuals or as local governments to do to help mitigate these issues in the future? Well, where do you use water around your house typically? When we start getting into the moderate or severe drought levels, that is the main emphasis for folks. Just think about where your water is coming from, whether that's from your local lake, whether it's from your city, even if you're a groundwater well in your backyard, but also think about how you're using that around your house. If I'm watering my lawn three times a week, maybe I could cut that back. How long are you leaving the water running while you're brushing your teeth or shaving? These are all small things, but they truly do add up if we, as a community, embrace that idea of conservation and working together. Question, what's the outlook for the Triangle's water supply? As climate change worsens, droughts, and as population growth puts more demand on the water supply, should we expect to be living under these conditions and restrictions more frequently? Well, there's no reason to believe that water restrictions will ever become every year sort of occurrence. It takes a prolonged period of exceptionally dry weather to get into a situation where restrictions are necessary. In other years, we tend to get plenty of rainfall, especially during the summer months, so that's never an issue. It is possible that with warmer temperatures and increasing demands, we could hit the trigger points for water restrictions sooner in the future, like if we slip into a hot, dry pattern during the summer months. But overall, our water supplies, like our large reservoirs, are designed to have plenty of capacity to last through even severe drought events. Question. It rained a couple times in the past few weeks, and so the drought probably isn't on people's minds the same way it was when it was super hot and dry? Did it make a difference? Well, the past week is a good example of the impact that rain can and can't have. The U.S. Corps of Engineers measured 0.99 inches of rain at Falls Lake over the past 7 days through June 22nd. But the lake itself still dropped about 0.3 of a foot, largely because of evaporation and a lack of rainfall farther upstream. But that's at least an improvement over recent weeks when it hadn't rained at all in the Triangle area and falls had dropped by 0.5 foot or more. If we could keep it up, that sort of pattern we're in this week, where we're getting average or slightly above average rainfall, would go a long way in helping us weather the drought this summer without it getting too much worse. For reference, the Raleigh area is about 9 inches below its normal precipitation so far this year. If that number doesn't get any worse by the end of summer, and if we start regularly getting 2 inches per week, then it would take 2 or 3 months to fully eliminate the deficit. Of course, that's still a long time, but the good news is that we would start to notice the improvements a lot sooner. The soil moisture and vegetation would perk up after a couple of events like that, and our lake levels would stabilize or start rising not long after that. In a best-case scenario, we would be in that sort of pattern by September, and by the time we go into next winter, even if we're still chipping away at the rainfall deficit or waiting for our lakes to fully refill, this drought could feel like it's already in our rearview mirror. And we should add that this article was written and posted on the Indy a couple of weeks ago. So that was then, and by gosh, this is now. Well, from doom and gloom, let's turn to something a lot more pleasant for especially the summer months. This next article, and I'll try to get it all in, is entitled Sunday Best, the Ultimate Guide to Wake County Ice Cream. Discover the Wake County Ice Cream Maker's flavoring summer treats with oolong tea, cheese churros, and good old-fashioned California strawberries and more. All right, let's get into it. Here we go. Set aside the Oaks, the Stanley Cup, and even the Tobacco Road basketball lore, Raleigh is an ice cream town, a cow-to-cone city in a frozen melting pot of a region churning with flavors from Greece, Thailand, Mexico, Japan, and, of course, North Carolina farms. The city's appetite for ice cream has deep roots. In the 1880s, shop proprietor Antonio Duggi, who ran a farm south of town, sold ice cream out of his Fayetteville Street shop and sent his horse-drawn ice cream cart to Peace College to satisfy student demand. A century later, in 1988, Raleigh became the birthplace of Harry Brathwaite's Goodberry's Frozen Custard, a venture launched with a boost from North Carolina State University's dairy experts. Today, Raleigh is home to ice cream royalty with spots like Andia's Ice Cream and Two Roosters on USA Today's lists of America's best ice cream shops. Andia's operates shops in Raleigh, Cary, and Durham, and owner Andia Zuris is a James Beard Fellow and a 2-time Grand Master Ice Cream Maker. A title, North American Ice Cream Association awards to a handful of chefs who have earned multiple blue ribbons over a period of years. Andia is a genius at flavors, said Laura Clemens, the business's director of operations. French vanilla, double dark chocolate, and mango jalapeno margarita are among Zuris's prize-winning concoctions. Now, Two Roosters Ice Cream owner Jared Plummer, an NC State accounting graduate, operates shops in Raleigh, Cary, Durham, and Wake Forest. The business often creates novelty flavors, as in April when Plummer launched a flavor collection created by Carolina Hurricanes players. Last summer, as part of a podcaster series, Two Roosters created a flavor to contribute or to celebrate local sports podcasts Ovies and Giglio. Co-host Joe Giglio wanted an ice cream that tastes like the best Reese's peanut butter cup you could ever imagine, and said Plummer nailed it. I like to call Jared a magician. I don't know how he gets the ice cream to hold all the flavor, but he does, Giglio said, adding that tasting Two Roosters ice cream transports you to where you were when you had that flavor for the first time. At Howling Cow Dairy Education Center and Creamery off Lake Wheeler Road, just 6 miles from the city's venue for opera and high art, you can wave at the cows that produce the milk that NC State students used to make your ice cream. The creamery is just across the pasture from NC State's 389-acre dairy farm, where the daily milking of more than 300 cows begins the day's production. Through underground lines, the milk travels from udders to a weigh station that gathers data on every offering from every cow. From there, lines carry the milk to a reservoir and then through a filtration system and on to cooling vessels. Once chilled, the milk rests in bulk tanks until an NC State dairy plant milk truck transports it 2,400 gallons at a time to Schaub Hall on Dan Allen Drive. Right there on campus, the processing facility pasteurizes and homogenizes the milk, churning out skim, low-fat, and whole milk, as well as heavy cream and a flavorless base mix that is stored in a silo until it's blended with flavors to make ice cream. Like chili, it's better the next day, said Carl Hollyfield, director of NC State's Dairy Enterprise System. From Schaub Hall, ice cream delivery trucks typically make two runs a week to Howling Cow. During the summer, creamery supervisor Taylor Nail adds a third delivery to meet demand. In the best sense, the farm and creamery make Raleigh a cow town. Relentless development has cost Wake County more than 30,000 acres of farmland in the last two decades, yet Howling Cow persists and customer affection is growing. For many families in Raleigh and the surrounding areas, this may be one of the few opportunities they have to experience a working dairy farm and see large farm animals up close, said Nail. That connection between agriculture, education, and community is a huge part of what makes Howling Cow special. On sunny weekends, the wait for Howling Cow ice cream can reach 45 minutes or longer. Still, Nail receives positive customer feedback. Folks admire how NC State students who staff the operation keep it all moving. Guests gravitate to the rocking chairs on the porch, and kids find free-range moments in the meadow and climb the fence to get a better look at the cows. This spring, for the first time, Nail invited staff to come up with new flavors. From 30 submissions, they settled on 6 finalists that will make it to the test kitchen. If a flavor works great in production, they'll take it to Palm Springs in November for KonaCon, the North American Ice Cream Association's annual gathering. If the flavor shows well there, there's a good chance she'll add it to the freezer case at Howling Cow, where Wolf Tracks, a vanilla ice cream loaded up with fudge swirl and mini peanut butter cups, is consistently a top seller. Across Wake County's 857 square miles from McLean Farms and Fuquay Arena to Lumpy's in Wake Forest, from Daughter's Soft Serve in Wendell to Mama Bird's in Apex, more than 120 parlors, wake-up, walk-up windows, dine-in joints, and specialty shops feature ice cream. The geographic distribution matters. Widespread availability is a good thing. Ice cream is an analog amenity that fosters human connection. People leave their houses for ice cream. They meet up and congregate in public spaces. Ice cream represents a victory for Epicureanism's good life over Stoicism's indifference to pleasure. They say that ice cream has a very special ability to evoke memories and nostalgia, because you take a bite and you lick the ice cream and the flavor is released as the butterfat melts in your tongue. It's a very nostalgic experience, says Maury McCarthy, founder and owner of Raleigh's Bold Batch Creamery. For me, I had to have ice cream every single night before I started making it myself. Going out for ice cream builds more than social capital. U.S. cities are competing on indicators of connectivity, and ice cream, along with coffee, art, and cocktails, is a magnet that pulls people into parks, galleries, and other shared spaces. Currently, 41% of Raleigh residents live within a half-mile walk to a park. Raleigh leaders are working to move up the rankings, and food and beverage are playing a central part in the city's greenway system and in new amenities such as Gibson Play Plaza, Flowers Cottage, Thomas Dambo's Trolls, and House of Many Porches Market. For cyclists, the city has mapped a 12-mile Howling Cow ice cream run, and the city is expanding its Greenway food vendor program to embed more culinary treats into parks. The Grey Dog Ice Cream Lab has joined the list of approved vendors. Andy's Ironworks location is on the Greenway alongside Crabtree Creek Trail, and ice cream lovers can knit together a Greenway route from Andy's to Two Roosters location in Lead Mine Road, which sits near Mine Creek Road, or that is the trail. Chef Andrew Zimmern, a restaurateur and TV personality, recently described The Triangle in an Instagram video is a place where serious chefs are doing thoughtful, ingredient-driven work and where global flavors and southern roots actually mean something on the plate. This is particularly true in Cary, where seekers can find an ice cream trail of global flavors. Start at the Two Roosters location at Waverly Place. And with scoops of coffee, bourbon, and blackberry hibiscus ice cream, head north on Kildare Farm Road. St. Bridget of Kildare is the patron saint of dairy farmers, among other things, to find Goodberry's Sir Walter Wally. I love that one, which blends vanilla custard, strawberries, chocolate chips, and wet walnuts. A block away at Sugar Koi. Not Jirasawad, a former sushi chef who grew up in Thailand, has mastered his mother's homemade coconut ice cream recipe. A decade ago, Jirasawad began teaching himself to make ice cream from scratch, discovering along the way that the ice cream he was producing was Philadelphia style, which is 16% butterfat, two or three times the butterfat of gelato. Now he creates original flavors using Asian teas and fruits and local produce. Simple and honest ingredients, he said. He spent 2 years working on a recipe for Genmacha tea ice cream. It comes to me in a dream. Now I have the perfect Genmacha ice cream, he said. He keeps ice cream in the freezer case year-round and rotates black sesame, honeydew, oolong tea, and other flavors. Heading east from Sugar Koi, the Andes Southeast Cary location is minutes away. A Cyprus native with Greek heritage, Zouris makes a baklava ice cream that somehow tastes more like baklava than it is than the dessert itself. As a reminder of the expanse of the ice cream universe, Dairy Queen is next door to Andia's, if you care to go there. To the north on East Chatham Street, Eric and Carlos Torres's Vida Dulce ice cream shop features many flavors that originated from the family's ice cream parlor in Guadalajara, Mexico. The cousins offer a churro split and Mexican ice cream flavors such as gansito, piñon, and zarzamora con queso, all of which sounds fine. And by the way, I'm kind of running out of time here, so just going to wrap this up, but get more on the indie. Run out of time for today's episode. Oh, there goes my clock. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Chris Canangla, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Indie Week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.